They thought their loved ones were safe behind bars.
No jail is safe. Don't get me wrong about that.
That's not always the case.
It's just a fortunate fact of life that when you have a huge population of people, they're by and large unhealthy. Some people are probably not going to make it.
In a year-long investigation by the USA Today Network Ohio Bureau, reporters made more than 135 public records requests and conducted dozens of interviews.
You better do something, because people are dying and their lives are worth something.
Now, Ohio Governor Mike DeWine is responding. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Lucy May. Our Friday news review starts with USA Today Network Ohio Bureau reporters Laura Bischoff and Aaron Glynn. They join us in this recorded interview to tell us what they found. Thanks for being here, Laura and Aaron.
Thanks for having us.
We want to let our listeners know this conversation will address suicide. Laura and Aaron, we just heard from some of the people you spoke with in your very powerful investigation. You found that at least 220 people died in Ohio's jails over a four-year period. One of them was Isaiah Trammell, who died later at the hospital. Tell us what happened to Isaiah.
Yes, Isaiah was a 19-year-old with autism. He was booked into the Montgomery County Jail on a domestic violence warrant from a year before that neither he nor his family knew existed. And when Isaiah was booked into the jail, he told deputies that he didn't want to live anymore. So they put him on suicide watch and placed him in a concrete cell by himself. Isaiah banged his head as a form of stimming, which is the kind of self-soothing behaviors that people with autism turn to. And he banged his head throughout the nearly 10 hours that he was booked into jail. Officers put him in a restraint chair twice. They kind of taunted, belittled him. They told him he was being embarrassing and ridiculous. And he was unconscious by the time he left the jail, and he never woke up.
And Aaron, Isaiah's mother told you jail staff should have known better. We're going to hear from her.
They knew he was autistic. Everybody knows somebody that's autistic. There's no way not one person there knew. The mental health specialist told him to quit being a crybaby.
Aaron, that's so tough to hear. What was the message that Isaiah's mother was trying to get out? That does she feel like this jail staff really needs to know better how to handle young people like Isaiah?
Yes, she thinks jail staff need better training, especially when handling people with the developmental disabilities. And also, she mentioned she wishes the jail staff weren't so overworked. She said she knows that they don't get breaks, like that they're understaffed. And she just thinks that the environment is kind of making people more jaded.
Laura, what prompted this investigation and where did it begin?
Well, actually, more than a year ago, I was down in Cincinnati covering the Householder trial, and I connected with Aaron, who at the time was at the Inquirer, and she had been looking at jail issues in Butler County, and I had already started pulling some data on what was going on statewide, and so we ended up collaborating over, we really kind of put our attention on it about a year ago. I was sidetracked also on doing that project, statewide project that published in November on conditions of confinement in the juvenile system. So the whole thing, it just took a while to pull it all together because Ohio is such a local control state. We had to request autopsy and coroner reports and investigative reports from, dozens and dozens of counties.
What are the most common causes of these deaths?
Well, about 29% are suicides. Another third or so are drug-related. Either people are overdosing on illicit drugs that they get while they are in custody from employees or other inmates. Some are dying of complications of detox. You go into jail and a lot of jails offer medication-assisted treatment, which will help ease some of the terrible symptoms. But some of those jails don't give it to people promptly, and that can lead to major problems, or they don't give it to them at all. That was the case in Butler County with Cody Bohannon. He didn't get that MAT. And in Richland County, Maggie Copeland went in and said that she was a regular heroin user and she was expecting to experience withdrawals. And they didn't start her on MAT until, I think, 3 days in. And by then, she was very altered and combative and suffering from vomiting and diarrhea and profuse sweating.
You know, you mentioned these drug-related deaths, and I think a lot of people figure that people who are addicted to drugs won't be able to get drugs in jail. But what's the reality, Laura?
Oh, in terms of getting opioids inside of jails, it's and in prisons, it's fairly common to have overdoses. Not every single day, but it's certainly a common occurrence. And I think that there've been instances in which law enforcement has busted guards or vendors or visitors from bringing it in. Sometimes, other people, they sneak it in a body cavity, or they've swallowed a baggie of drugs, et cetera. So it's not that hard.
And you were talking about, you know, how inmates are supposed to get medication-assisted treatment or MAT, and that just doesn't happen at all or soon enough for some people. Aaron, I think you mentioned that when Isaiah Trammell went into jail, he talked about potential self-harm. Jails are supposed to be monitoring people who might be suicidal, right? But what did your investigation find about that?
Yes. And if a person is on suicide watch in a county jail, they're supposed to be checked every 15 minutes, or they can be on a continuous watch, which means they are watched continuously and it's logged every 15 minutes. But we found that in a few cases, jails just weren't doing those kinds of checks, even wellness checks. People not on suicide watch are supposed to be checked every hour. And we found people went 5-4 hours without anyone noticing that they were unconscious. There was one case in Stark County where a guard was prosecuted for failing to log medical checks.
And investigation mentions several guards and personnel who get charged, who get prosecuted. But Laura, they don't always result in convictions, do they? That seems pretty rare.
Yeah, there was a case in Scioto County of a 56-year-old man named Kevin Bailey who was died after clashing with guards. And there was a acquittal in that case of a guard. Alexander Rios up in Richland County, he was tackled and tased. He turned blue and died a few days later. An officer who was charged in that case had a hung jury the first time around and then was acquitted in April.
And I do want to note that anyone who's in crisis or is having thoughts of suicide should call or text 988, the National Suicide Prevention Hotline. I want to hear from both of you about some of the specific stories that parents told you about their children who died, just how helpless they felt not being able to protect a child, even a child who's an adult who was in prison.
Yeah, I mean, there's the case of Malcolm Willis. He was 21 years old. He was incarcerated in Franklin County and then transferred to Ross County. We heard from a clip of his mom talking at the front end of this segment. And he told them that he was going to be withdrawing, that he had withdrawal symptoms. He asked for medical attention. Those requests were largely unheeded. And he ended up hanging himself in jail in Ross County. And his family filed a lawsuit. It turns out nobody checked on him in person for, I think, 5 hours. His mom says, I just don't want there to be any more Malcolms. I don't want other families to go through what I'm going through and the pain that she's feeling. Up in Richland County, you know, you hear the same things. You hear it in Franklin County, pretty much every single county. It's parents who you know, their child ended up in jail. They thought they'd be safe and they weren't.
Yes, there was a similar case. Laura mentioned Cody Bohannon, who died after going through withdrawals in the Butler County Jail. He was there for just 4 days. And according to his family's lawsuit, he was vomiting. He was too weak to stand, but he didn't get the medical treatment he needed. And his mother told us that she still pays for his cell phone plan because she can't really accept that he's not here anymore. She said she thought when he went into jail that he would have an opportunity to get clean, but she said that was a false sense of security.
Well, that seems like something that you heard from more than one parent, people saying, okay, I know my child had a problem, especially young adults with substance use disorder. I know my child was addicted to heroin or some kind of opioid. At least in jail, they'll get clean. They'll get help with that. Isn't that something you heard over and over?
Absolutely. That was very much a common refrain. It was kind of eerie how we heard it from multiple families who didn't know each other.
What kind of care are jails supposed to provide under the law?
Ohio jails have 181 standards, and that ranges from medical treatment to how hot the showers are, how much light there is in the cells at night so people can sleep. And jails are inspected every year. There are 9 state inspectors. But if a jail is failing to meet the standards repeatedly, there aren't really any consequences. The Ohio has an option to take a jail to the County Court of Common Pleas to enforce jail standards, but it's never done that.
Yeah, the DeWine administration has chosen to, I would say, offer more carrots and less stick. They've surged about $175 million into jail construction projects. Some of the problems of failure to meet these standards are because some of the jails are very old. So they've tried to kind of coax the county sheriffs into making improvements. And you know, it's very costly. You know, you look at like Franklin County, they spent $350 million building a brand new jail. But it does have like a whole wing with, I think, 80 beds for people who are going through detox.
Well, and Laura, what else did the governor tell you when you talked to him? Because the governor is quoted in your investigation. You have audio from him as part of the videos that you put together for this. And it sounds like he's concerned, but, you know, there's only so much he's willing to do.
Yeah, like I said, he told us back in January that he felt that taking county sheriff's departments to court would be a so-called nuclear option, and that he preferred to work with them and offer technical advice and help them comply with these standards. And then we talked with the governor again yesterday after the publication of the project. And he said that, you know, maybe there's room for stronger state oversight. But again, he really wants to work with the sheriffs. One area he did say is that he thought that all of the deaths should be investigated by third parties rather than by the sheriff's department that actually runs the jail where the death happened.
And is there a way to do that under law to require a third party to investigate? Is there any kind of system in place for that?
Not currently. Some sheriff's departments will ask the Bureau of Criminal Investigation run by the Attorney General's office to come in and investigate, and that happens, I would say, in a handful, a fraction of the cases. A lot of the BCI investigations are dozens of pages long, whereas the sheriff's investigations are typically 2 to 4 pages.
Let's talk a little bit more about what's supposed to happen in jails across the state of Ohio. Are jails supposed to have special procedures for people who have autism or other disabilities?
Yes, there are standards and policies for handling people with developmental disabilities and for the use of things like restraint chairs. Mostly jail staff are supposed to be calm, explain exactly what they're doing, and why they're doing it, what behavior it would take to get out of the restraint chair. And restraint chairs, by the way, are never supposed to be used for punishment or for convenience of jail staff. They're only supposed to be used to prevent someone from harming themselves or other people. We saw in the Montgomery County video, though the Montgomery County investigation found that the jail staff hadn't done anything wrong, in the video, they're clearly not following Ohio's policies on restraint chairs.
How often do people end up in jail when they're experiencing a mental health crisis, Erin?
We found that about 16,000 people are struggling with mental illness in Ohio county jails. Usually when people are booked into county jails, it's, you know, the worst day of their life. They are going through a crisis. It's very common to be, it's a difficult population to deal with. People are upset. And that's why jail staff are supposed to be trained to be calm and handle things appropriately.
And yeah, we found actually there were some, there's some national studies that show that in jails, like 30% have serious mental illnesses, and about 65% have some sort of drug abuse issues. So, and also like Dallas Baldwin, the sheriff in Franklin County, told us that by and large, this is a pretty unhealthy population that comes into the jails. There's about 16,500 people in jails on any given night, 300,000 bookings each year across Ohio.
And Laura, why do people who are having a mental health crisis, why do they so often end up going to jail instead of a psychiatric facility or a hospital?
Well, in large part because, you know, Ohio, like other states, shut down most of its state psychiatric hospitals decades ago and didn't fulfill the promise to build out a robust community mental health system. And there have been steps toward training Ohio's 36,000 law enforcement officers to in crisis intervention and de-escalation and recognizing mental health crises. But in large part, there's a lot of times where they just don't have an option of where to take somebody when they're in a crisis. And so jail is kind of the de facto mental health hospital for Ohio.
What do advocates say it's going to take to change this system?
Well, I would say that, you know, the first answer is diversion. Fewer people ending up behind bars in the first place. So better response to people experiencing mental health crises or drug addiction. So better treatment, more options, more crisis centers. That would help prevent people from going into jail in the first place. Then there's also been a long debate, it seems pretty much dead in Ohio, about bail reform. And, you know, the ACLU has done some work on who's in jail because they can't make money bail. And a large portion of people are stuck behind bars because they don't have the bank account to, you know, come up with $400 or so to get out. So the advocates say, you know, fewer people behind bars is the number one step. I think sheriffs and state lawmakers, the fact that their answer is to build better jails. And that's why we're spending $175 million in state money on jail improvement projects and why counties like Franklin have, you know, poured a bunch of money into a brand new jail.
Yeah, we did talk to a lot of advocates who are skeptical that jails can ever be places where people recover because they were built and designed to punish people, not to heal them.
And Erin, I know you both talked to a lot of family members of the people who died. What do they want to see happen?
They want more dignity for their loved ones and people in incarceration. A lot of them said they just wish jail staff had cared a little bit more. John Copeland said he wished his daughter Maggie had been given a drink of water. She died of dehydration related to substance use. But many of them just vocalized better training, more care shown by jail staff.
Laura, anything you want to add in terms of what you heard from family members?
Well, yeah, I mean, a common refrain was like, there should be better training, there should be more compassion, more accountability, and more dignity. You know, I will say this is a really hard job. You know, you deal with a difficult population. There's, you know, the jails are open 24/7, so some people have to work a lousy shift. That said, this is what you signed up for, and that's something I also heard from the families was, you know, do the job that you signed up for.
Well, I've been talking in this recorded interview with USA Today Network Ohio Bureau reporters Laura Bischoff and Aaron Glenn. I really hope that lots of people read this work that you've put together. It's so powerful. Thank you both so much for your time today.
Thank you.
You're
Thank
welcome.
you.
Thank you.
Up next, there's a problem with the plumbing in Cincinnati. We'll talk with the people behind the new podcast, Backed Up. This is Cincinnati Edition. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Lucy May. You might have noticed on the WVXU website an invitation to listen to a new crappy podcast. Don't be fooled by the pun. Backed Up, a new podcast series that works to demystify the workings of Cincinnati's sewer system, is terrific. Joining me now in this recorded interview to explain its origins and the story it tells are WVXU local government reporter Becca Costello and WVXU podcast coordinator Ella Rowan. Thanks for being here, Becca and Ella.
Thanks for having us.
Becca, where did you two come up with this idea to do a podcast about sewers?
Well, to be fair, they were kind of separate ideas at first. So a podcast idea and reporting on the sewers. We had an opportunity to apply for a grant through PRX, that's Public Radio Exchange. And the idea was, you know, what could we do a podcast about? We want to kind of grow that here at Cincinnati Public Radio. Separately from that, you know, we've done a lot of reporting on MSD and the consent decree, but there's a lot of stuff going on that we haven't followed up on recently. And I thought, hey, seems like lots of people would want to listen to a podcast about the sewers. Ha ha. But here we are a year later, and it seems like that might be true. So,
and after all this work, Becca, how do you explain in like a sentence what the problem is with the Metropolitan Sewer District?
So the short answer of what the problem is that sewage, untreated sewage, ends up where it doesn't belong. And that can be in waterways like the Mill Creek and the Ohio River, and it can be in people's basements, backing up through toilets and floor drains. And the reason for that is because Cincinnati has what's called a combined sewer system, which means everything that goes down the toilet and everything that comes from the clouds and goes into the storm system, that all shares the same pipe. So when there's too much rain, there's not enough room, and it has to go somewhere.
We have some audio that explains that a little bit.
Cincinnati, early city engineers made a conscious decision to build a combined sewer system, not only reflecting cost, but also reflecting benefit. You were capturing everything that you needed to capture.
Who is that?
So that's Jack Rennekamp. He worked for MSD for about 30 years. He's also a highly educated historian, basically the expert on sewer history in Cincinnati, which was really helpful for us. And I think his main point is, you know, this was not a mistake. It's not like someone was negligent or, you know, did a bad design necessarily. Although today we think, why would you ever put those two together? But this was state-of-the-art technology when it was constructed, and it solved a lot of the city's health problems because before, sewage was not taken anywhere. So eventually we knew more about health and protecting the environment, protecting people. But at the time, this was the best solution.
Ella, what was your reaction to this idea? Were you all in from the start, or did it take you a minute to jump on the sewer podcast bandwagon?
I was all in. We had a big pitch meeting, and there were a lot of great pitches, but we ended up voting down to three, and then everybody voted on those three. But yeah, I was sewer all the way from day one.
And why is this? I know our listeners can't see that you're wearing toilet paper earrings, so I don't know if this is just a passion for you or what made you so excited about the sewer podcast idea.
Well, poop and pee are everyone's passion to some degree, Lucy. But yeah, no, it's become personal for me, absolutely. I think as a sound designer, talking about the sewers is such a good opportunity to find great sound effects. And then from a storytelling perspective, we've had all kinds of opportunities to like put in puns and like make a topic that can be pretty hard to digest. Ha ha ha. Really entertaining and funny and make it resonate with everybody.
Becca, tell us how you begin to tell this complicated story in episode one, which is available on our website right now, wvxu.org.
there's kind of a lot of different angles to this, and that's why we ended up going with a 6-episode series. But in this first episode, we really try to look at what is actually the problem and what does that look like? Because thankfully, not everyone has experienced a sewer backup or walking through a creek that has raw sewage in it. So that's a good thing. But we need to kind of show what this story is then. You know, how does it impact people? So we talked to several folks who've had sewer backups in their home. In the first episode, you'll meet Florence Miller. She's in her 70s, and she lives in kind of on the border of Clifton and North Avondale. She's lived in that home for 50 years, lifelong Cincinnatian, and talked about the really difficult experience of raw sewage coming up through her drains in her basement.
Let's hear from Florence.
Yeah, that storm just hung over all these neighborhoods and just destroyed, you know, people's homes. And, you know, some of them had health issues after that, too. Fortunately, yeah, I asked the doctor, I said, well, we were standing in sewage water, you know, maybe for, you know, a couple minutes trying to get out. And she said, well, as long as you don't ingest it, you should be all right. I wouldn't wish this on anyone. Yeah. Nobody should have to deal with this kind of stuff.
I'm not sure you need a doctor to tell you not to ingest sewer water, but I appreciate that advice. That is just so awful to think about. Yeah. Ella, what made you two to decide to take kind of a Scooby-Doo mystery solving approach to this storytelling?
Yeah, we came across that idea while meeting with our mentors at PRX through this grant. They kind of saw Becca and I's relationship with each other and our friendship, and they thought it would be fun to bring like sort of a kids on bikes approach is what we're calling it. So like Stranger Things or just like wacky characters trying to solve a mystery together. And I think that made it also easier for us to see like how we're actually going to tell the story.
Mm-hmm. Becca, for people who are listening to this podcast, I hope everyone listens because it's so good. Who are the characters in this story, the key people that you two interviewed, that people should really pay attention to throughout?
So, you know, like I said, we talked to folks who kind of have firsthand experience with this, and each episode you'll meet kind of a new person or a new community that's dealing with this in a unique way. But throughout the series, you will kind of get to know these are not really, they're characters, but they're not individual people, which is kind of interesting. But so we've got the city of Cincinnati, we've got MSD, which is the Metropolitan Sewer District of Greater Cincinnati. There's the county, Hamilton County. And in a lot of ways, these are individual characters that we have to explore their relationships with one another, because that's a big part of the problem. As you know, as we said, combined sewer systems were state-of-the-art technology at one time. Lots of big older cities have at least partially combined sewer systems. So what makes Cincinnati different from all those cities is the organization structure. It's this complicated relationship between the city and the county that has kind of been a tug of war, like a power struggle over who's in charge of the sewer district for a long time. So in order to tell that story, we really did kind of have to treat these as characters and explain who they are, what their history is, and what their relationship is to each other.
Yeah, you really end up kind of humanizing these big institutions and organizations, and you do it in such a clever way. I don't want to do any spoiler alerts, but listeners should listen for the wedding bells because it's really a really fun part of it. Ella, you referred to this a little bit earlier. You made a lot of audio magic happen on this podcast. Were you at all worried about how to make it interesting from an audio perspective? I mean, there are only so many times you can play a flushing toilet sound in this thing.
That is so true. And I had to cut several flushes ultimately. Yeah, of course I was worried. I think it's kind of a zen thing of sitting down with all of the tracks. This first episode had 52 tracks, which is the most tracks I've had in any kind of project like this. But it's just a matter of listening over and over, taking notes, like, what did I like this time? What can I change? And just getting a ton of feedback from everybody who works here and making it better over time.
And I don't think people who aren't in this business, and I mean, I'm even kind of in this business and I don't totally understand, how much time does it take for that audio piece of a podcast like this? There's so much time that goes into the interviews and the research, but just the audio piece, how much time does that take?
Yeah, so we have to, first you do a rough cut where you just edit together all of the interviews you've done and the voiceover and put them in order. That takes at least, I don't know, 2 hours. And then
it would take me way longer. So.
I do it every day, so I've gotten better at it. But it takes a long time. Then you know, listening through and going, okay, what kind of archival sound can we bring in? Finding that, and then adding music, I would say takes the longest time. What a lot of people probably don't realize when they're listening is any song that you hear in the podcast is actually a full 3-minute song that I have edited down to fit the beats of the story. Mm-hmm. So it's deciding like, okay, maybe there's a moment in the first episode where I have this piano sound that plays after Becca says combined sewer system for the first time, and it goes and it's like all mysterious. Like it took way too long to decide where that should go.
And all this time you could have just gone.
That's true. People would have loved it.
Can I brag on this a little bit, Lucy? Because sure. Yeah. Before coming into this, I don't listen to many podcasts. I had never made a podcast before. And I think for a lot of folks, you hear podcasts and you often think like just two people sitting at a microphone. And that's what a lot of podcasts are. And that's wonderful. But that's not what this is. This is art. This is, you know, the first time I heard a mix that Ella had put together with all of the interviews and script that we had done, I got chills. Like it's just so different. Aww. than I think what I typically thought of podcasts as. So I would just really encourage people, if you don't see yourself as a podcast person, just give this a try and see. I think you might. I'm getting chills now. I got goosebumps. it's different.
Okay, well, I would agree with that. The first episode is available now on our website, wbxu.org. I encourage everyone to listen to it. Even if you heard backed up on Cincinnati Edition on Wednesday, we had to cut a few minutes of this precious podcast to make it fit on our show. So listen to the whole thing on wbxu.org. Becca, tell us briefly, when will the next episodes be available, and just a little bit about what we should be expecting to hear about those.
So it's a total of 6 episodes. The first episode was released on Wednesday, June 5th, and we're releasing new episodes on Wednesdays after that. So the last one will be Wednesday, July 10th. And basically just go wherever you get your podcasts. You can subscribe and be notified when there's a new episode. Or if you're not much of a podcast person, you can also just go to wvxu.org/backedup and just listen to it right there on the browser. So it's easy for everyone.
Well, I've been talking with WVXU local government reporter Becca Costello and WVXU podcast coordinator Ella Rowan. Thank you both so much for your time today. Up next, Cincinnati City Council voted to pass a major overhaul of the city's zoning code. We break it down. This is Cincinnati Edition. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Lucy May. Cincinnati City Council this week approved a major overhaul of the city's zoning code known as Connected Communities. The vote wasn't unanimous, though, and many residents remain angry about the change. Joining me in this recorded interview to talk about Connected Communities are WVXU local government reporter Becca Costello. Thanks for sticking around, Becca.
Happy to be here still, Lucy.
And Cincinnati Business Courier staff reporter and columnist Chris Wetterich. Welcome back, Chris.
Thanks, Lucy. Good to see you.
Good to see you too. Becca, we've been talking a lot about Connected Communities, which is a huge change to the city's zoning code. Tell us again, just briefly, what big changes this will make now that it has passed.
Yeah, briefly is tough, but some of the major components are that it focuses zoning changes along major transit corridors and in neighborhood business districts. So it's not citywide, or at least there are very few changes that are citywide. In those areas, generally speaking, with some exceptions, housing with up to 4 units would be allowed, even if parts in that zoning are currently for single family only. So it does affect some single family zoning. It also reduces or eliminates the density and parking restrictions. So that's the number of units that are most number of units available, not available, allowed, sorry, in a multifamily. And then parking minimums are the number of parking spaces that are required for each housing unit or each, you know, whatever square footage of commercial. So those aren't completely done away with, but in some cases it's significantly reduced, and in some cases there are no parking minimums.
Okay. And Chris, what was the council vote breakdown on this?
It was 6-3, and the no votes were Victoria Parks, Vice Mayor J. Michelle Lemon Kearney, and Councilman Scotty Johnson.
How did they explain their no votes?
They were all somewhat concerned about affordable housing. They would have preferred to see something in the legislation, and I'm just generalizing here. There was a little variation in the 3 opinions, I think. But, you know, Kearney in particular wanted to see a mandate that developers build some affordable units in their projects as they take advantage of this new zoning code, or the new changes to the zoning code.
So she wanted to see that as a requirement, which it is not in the Connected Communities plan.
It is not. And, you know, there's developers have come to council many times to explain why that is not feasible for them. The rents, just to shorthand it, the rents in Cincinnati, while increasing, are generally not high enough to support that kind of mandate. You see that, you know, in other cities. Kearney cited Minneapolis for one, which is a city that they've used to kind of promote this. But, you know, I also think of New York City as a, you know, as a market where that's mandated and the rents clearly support it there. So that's an argument that council has been having going back to several councils ago. I mean, when David Mann was on council, he looked at that. The administration, you know, briefed him, and I think they convinced him that that was not a good idea. But I think it's a debate we're going to continue to have.
Becca, what about the council members and mayor who supported the plan? What was their main reason for getting behind this?
Yeah, you know, housing is not the only thing in this plan, but the conversation does kind of always come back to housing, and that was the main reason for the support of this plan. And I should say that, you know, the split was the opponents who said, we like a lot of this, but it's not ready, but it doesn't have everything we need. And then the supporters, all enthusiastic. There were no sort of undecided or on the fence votes on the supporting side. The idea is that the city is growing in population for the first time in a long time. Officials want that to continue, but there's not enough housing to support a growing population. That's because even though there is construction going on, which we know, obviously, you see developments going up, and that's hard to understand how there's not enough housing in the city. But the city is also losing a lot of housing stock every year, including last year, citywide. So the pace of construction is not keeping up with the demand. And so the argument is that in terms of affordability, that when supply and demand aren't matched up, that's when you get skyrocketing rates, or rents rather. And that basically just having more supply will kind of, market forces will keep those rents a lot lower. Hmm.
Lots of people have expressed their thoughts about this in various forums in recent weeks. Let's hear from Kelly Hibbett, a West Side resident who opposes the plan.
With the influx of the out-of-town landlords and the institutional landlords, they know all the tricks in the book. And until we get a grip on that, things like the Connected Communities, which sounds beautiful and wonderful, is not going to work, because in the west side of town, the people who are going to take advantage of that are the slumlords and those out-of-town investors.
Chris, how did the mayor or council members who supported this plan, how did they address these concerns about institutional investors who might not have the best interests of the community in mind?
The mayor's rhetoric on institutional investors has been very strident. He's noted that the city administration, let's be clear, filed suit against some of these institutional investors, the folks who, you know, are kind of backed by Wall Street money and come in and buy, you know, vast portfolios of single family housing and then raise the rents. And there's questions about whether they properly keep up the homes that they do buy. So he has said that they are going to be very aggressive and continue to be in court against those folks who don't keep their properties up to snuff.
Becca, opponents of Connected Communities have joined together under the name Coalition for a Better Cincinnati. What does this group say it's planning to do about this plan?
Yeah, so and to be clear, you know, as we've already talked about here a little bit today, there are lots of opponents and they don't always agree with each other on why they oppose it. So even within this group, there's some diversity of opinion there. And this group does not necessarily encompass all of the opposition. But they are threatening to sue, which is not a surprise. There are a couple of things. One, you know, we've seen lawsuits challenging zoning changes like this in other cities that have made similar changes over the last several years. So even just on the merits of the zoning change, not that surprising. The other thing is that council passed this ordinance as an emergency with an emergency clause. And what that does is, first, it allows it to go into effect immediately, whereas ordinances without an emergency clause go into effect typically after 30 days. The other thing, though, more significantly, is that it prevents the city citizens from overturning that with a referendum. So they could gather
thousands of signatures, probably, I think they need, Chris, you did this, like around 9,000 signatures. But in order to actually get it on the ballot, you need about double that to make sure they're all valid. But, it, you know, that could be put on the ballot. And, you know, as unpopular as it is, it might be overturned. But because this was passed as an emergency, it cannot be put on the ballot that way. So that is one basis for the potential of a lawsuit to say, is this, was this really an emergency? Did it need to be passed that way? Mm-hmm.
You know, as far as the ballot initiative, and I've asked about this, while they cannot have a referendum on what was passed, the citizens of Cincinnati have the power to initiate an ordinance. And in theory, they could replace the current ordinance that just passed with the old language. I asked the city solicitor's office about this, and they were kind of inconclusive, too early to tell whether that you know, setup could be workable for the opponents. I also asked the mayor about it, yesterday after the vote, and he said, quote, on any issues, if citizens feel the need to organize a ballot initiative, we have set up a process to empower them to do that. He didn't take a position on whether he thought that would be legal or not. You know, as far as the politics of that, you know, if they are able to do, you know, an initiative, they could they could choose their electorate, basically, whereas the clock is ticking in terms of a referendum if they were able to do that. So it might, in the long term, be better for them to be able to pick their electorate, because otherwise this would go in November when we have a lot of voters, a lot of renters, a lot of people who are young who've tended to favor this ordinance over the older homeowners that were opposed to it.
And just to be clear, we're recording this conversation on Thursday. The full council vote was Wednesday, but folks are going to hear it on Friday. So we're going to make this as complicated as possible today. let's hear from a resident who expressed support for the plan. This is Aspen Dameron.
I would like to make a point to the commission about the kinds of people that have shown up and spoken at this meeting today. They are primarily white, older homeowners. I would like to point out that this is largely disproportionate and unrepresentative of Cincinnati as a whole, where the residents are 60% renters, only 45% white, and mostly under 50. I came today to add my voice as a young, mixed-race renter. I want to express my support for connected communities totally and wholeheartedly. The proposed changes to our zoning codes are evidence-based and proven to increase housing production and combat rising rents or even lower rents in some cities. I love Cincinnati and would like to not only keep living here, but someday even own a home or condo in this city. I will never be able to do that if our housing stock is artificially limited by our restrictive zoning code.
Becca, does that reflect a lot of the kind of pro-connected community sentiments that you heard during all these hearings and meetings?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I think it is true that, as Chris said, generally a lot of the support for connected communities was coming from younger generations. And that's not that surprising. You know, obviously that's the maybe folks in my age and younger who I don't own a home. And, you know, that's the economic possibilities for doing that, the financial stability for doing that is a little bit less possible for those generations. So yeah, definitely. And a lot of agreement on that side of things in terms of we need more housing. We see this as a simple solution. And I will say too, even some of the opponents said to council, going back to this inclusionary zoning issue, we want you to change zoning. We want you to allow multifamily in some single family zones, but we think that you should make it mandatory to make some of that affordable. So even among some of the opposition, obviously not everyone, there was support for the zoning changes, but they just didn't want those zoning changes to be enacted without the mandatory affordability piece.
On that point, I mean, the opponents on council, the three no votes, they did not really get into or question the upzoning, the increase in density that was allowed. That was kind of a rout. I would say if the inclusionary zoning in terms of requiring affordable housing was included, this would have been a 9-0 vote, because people on council were generally in favor of the increased density that this ordinance would have will provide.
And that's huge. Like, I think that's really, really significant. That and parking was another big concern of some opponents. didn't really hear much concerns about parking from the three opponents on this.
No.
I will say the one thing, I think for the most part, there was a most agreement that the community engagement piece, that the city did a lot of community engagement. The only council member who really talked about that piece in a negative way was Scotty Johnson. And he said, even if the city's done more than they ever have before, which I think is true, he said, you know, as long as some people feel like they were left out of the process, you know, we didn't do enough. So that was one area where he did say, you know, he did have some agreement with some of the opponents.
Yeah. And we certainly heard that as the people who put together Cincinnati Edition. We heard from a lot of people who felt like they weren't heard.
I would say that was probably the biggest complaint. So the one thing that everybody that opposed it agreed on was that they didn't like the community engagement piece of it.
Yeah. Chris, we've heard from listeners about what these changes will mean for developers. And there is a lot of, there's some concern about that too, I should say. Are these changes good for developers? Are they bad for developers? Are they neutral? What do they mean for the people who build housing?
I did a story this week talking specifically to developers about one aspect of this that would allow townhomes, which are, you know, there's basically single family homes that they're attached to each other. They're, you know, row houses is another word for them. So I did a story about that and the contention that this will allow, you know, kind of a flurry of that kind of housing product. And so the developers that I talked to are, you know, they're generally in favor of that. They like that idea. The question about it, though, is whether those will truly be affordable. When we looked at the projects that are going on in the city that are townhome, row homes, they are not, you know, what I would say affordable in terms of they're not 250, 200, 250, 300. And even for some people, that's far out of range. But they tend, you know, they tend to be $500,000 or more. And the developers I talked to said, well, we don't really see how that changes, even with economies of scale, even if we could suddenly all build, you know, hundreds of these things. You know, we're not sure that this would actually change the amount of money we would have to charge because of the interest rates that are going on out there and construction cost increases, the things that we've heard since the pandemic about inflation in those areas. The mayor, when I asked him about this specific point, he said, well, the city's going to need to be willing to subsidize that kind of housing. And so that's, you know, that's a significant you know, statement by him, because I don't feel like we had heard that a lot up until then, that he would, you know, that the city's checkbook would come out to help developers build more affordable types of townhomes. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we'll see going forward. It certainly does allow a denser product. As far as the rest of the legislation, I mean, this, we've heard all along, this is aimed at middle housing, the 2, 3, and 4-plexes. We don't see a lot of that product developed right now. Mm-hmm. Developers that are active tend to build large multifamily buildings. And so it's a question as to whether developers will emerge to do that type of project. I'm struck by something that Daniela Beltran, the planning commissioner, said a few weeks ago, which was, you know, we just don't have a lot of experience with smaller developers. That doesn't exist as much here as it might do other places. And one reason to do this connected communities change is to allow for smaller developers like to emerge that will do those products.
Well, we will keep watching for how this unfolds and what the political ramifications are for members of council and the mayor. I've been talking with WVXU local government reporter Becca Costello and Cincinnati Business Courier staff reporter and columnist Chris Wetterich. Thank you both so much for your time today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Our producer is Selena Reeder. Associate producer is Asiya Johnson. Technical director is Marshall Verbsky. And our intern is Olivia Gilliand. I'm Lucy May. Thanks for listening.